To really understand what took place in Wounded Knee, South Dakota from February 27th to May 8th, I would first of all have to go back and give you at least a little history of the formation of the American Indian Movement, its objectives and goals, why it was formed, who they looked at as the worst enemy of Indian people, and what they have done in the past 5 years to create some type of social change. The American Indian Movement itself was formed in July of 1968 in the city of Minneapolis. It was formed by a group of Indian people who came together from many walks of life, from many different tribes, from many different levels of education, for many different cultures and many different traditions. This was considered one of the largest Indian gatherings ever to take place in the city of Minneapolis. And yet, out of approximately 12 to 14,000 Indians who reside in the metropolitan area of Minneapolis-St. Paul, only 130 Indians came together that particular night. People have made statements throughout the country in the past 25 years since the formation of the National Congress of American Indians that every Indian organization that came together supposedly to be an advocate for Indian people has either folded or had become a white-orientated type of organization where the Indian continuously looked to the white man for direction. And as I travel across this country, I am confronted every day, and generally it's by my own people, because they have been living under a paternalistic attitude since birth. The government, the Office of Education, and the Christian Church. And they believe that they cannot get along without these three institutions. They believe that these institutions cannot be changed. They have accepted the white man's way to such a degree that they have lost their identity. And we found this out when we formed the American Indian Movement in the city of Minneapolis. The people who gathered there that night were dissatisfied. They felt that little of nothing was being done by this government to honor the treaties made with Indian people. They felt that even their own so-called Indian organizations were not doing anything to create any type of social change in their community. And as we looked at the makeup of all these organizations across the country, we knew that one way or the other, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Office of Education, and the Christian Church not only influenced those boards but controlled them with their funding process. And when the American Indian Movement formed in July of 1968, calling themselves the Concerned Indian American Coalition at first, they were determined that this was going to be an Indian organization. It was going to be totally Indian in concept, that only people with Indian heritage and Indian blood and culture were going to make decisions for Indian people as far as this organization was concerned. And we didn't just start it, you know, out of the clear blue sky. It wasn't just a bunch of militants that sat down and said we're going to start another organization and receive a lot of funds and then forget about the people. It started as a grassroots organization that met many times in homes and cars and cafes because nobody would provide a meeting place for people like this. But it came together anyway. And to demonstrate its concern for Indian people, it immediately attacked these three institutions that we felt were the three key enemies of Indian people, being the church, the federal government through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and education. And we were talking about a white European education, one that's history is built on conquest and victory. And when we talked about the church, we were talking about people who came here first seeking religious freedom. We talked about a church that participated prior to any treaty that was ever made in forced assimilation of the Indian person as a human being. We talked about a Bureau of Indian Affairs that controlled Indian people's lives for 149 years, controlled everything they did, controlled the leasing of their land, determined what school they could go to, what type of education they could get. These were the things that were discussed in the early part of 1968 in these founding conferences that took place. And after it was all over, we came out with a list of objectives. Objectives that were designed to turn the history of Indian people around in this country. Objectives that were designed to give Indian people back their sovereign rights that they had when they made treaties with the United States government and set aside for themselves. And in those meetings that we had in the early part of 1968, about 80 people dropped out of the founding conference. We invited them to leave because we said that we meant business. We told them that we were all through bullshitting. We weren't going to stay on our knees for the rest of our life. We were going to stand up and we were going to be counted. And those people who had any hang-ups, now there's time to get out. But if they ever felt like coming back and being part of this movement, the door would always be open. One of the biggest problems facing the Indian community at that time was a police problem. In the city of Minneapolis, there was approximately 40 to 55 Indian people arrested weekly. You could set your watch when the paddy wagons would come down to East Franklin and load Indian people up. And when they went to, by the time they went to court the next day, they weren't just arrested for minor intoxication or breach of peace. They also had tacked on to those charges, resisting arrest, attempted assault, using profanity in public, and etc. And because Indian people did not have money to defend themselves, they immediately threw them a public defender who negotiated a plea and got them 60 to 90 days in a workhouse. And the workhouse was nearly 50% Indian. The American Indian Movement immediately launched an all-Indian citizens patrol to monitor the police, to show up the next day as witnesses in court, to provide some type of bail bond system to get these people out and establish a defense. And we told Indian people that they did not have to plead guilty anymore. They didn't have to negotiate any plea. If they wanted a jury trial, they could have it. And within a three-month period, we had the courts backlogged for over 18 months in jury trials. For 22 straight weeks, we were successful stopping Indian people from getting their heads beat in, stop young girls from being molested and even raped by policemen. And Indian people throughout the country saw the effectiveness of this organization. And within a three-month period, we had over 600 members registered. And before the year was over, they estimated that 80% of the metropolitan area and surveys that were taken supported the American Indian Movement. I had the opportunity to participate in an all-Indian task force in 1967-68. It was funded under the Ford Foundation. And the purpose of this task force was to investigate the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the church, and education. The purpose of this task force was to expose these three institutions and how they worked as in a conspiracy to rip Indian people off of not only their culture and their heritage, but their land and their natural resources. And after logging over 100,000 miles traveling across this country to urban settings and to reservations, we came up with statistics that were almost unbelievable. And these were based on 850,000 Indians that are registered now under the Interior Department in the United States. We found out that the gross annual income of the Indian per family is set at $1,500 a year. We found out that for every white child that's born today in the United States and lives, three Indian children don't make it in the first month. We found out that if Indian people live to be 43.5, and for white America, it's 65 plus. We found out that we had a suicidal rate 20 times the national average. 65% of our students were dropping out of high school. And we had a 5.5 grade level. People ask me today, they don't say, how come you're so savage anymore? How come you're such a heathen because you don't believe in Jesus Christ? They ask me, how come I'm so militant? Maybe it's because I have witnessed these things all my life and have attempted to do something about it and was unable to until the movement was formed, until Indian people made up their minds themselves that they were going to shed everything that was instilled in their mind that was white and wrong. We immediately, after the formation of the movement, launched an all-out attack against the churches because we knew that the churches were the first to come here. They were the first to exploit the Indian. We knew that just 50 years after they ate that Thanksgiving dinner, thanking not only Jesus Christ but for Indian people, because Indian people were the ones that saved them. Over 50% of the Pilgrim Fathers that landed perished the first winter. And it was Indian people who came out of the woods and administered medicine. They even found medicine for the new diseases that they brought with them and cured them, showed them how to plant their crops, showed them what berries to eat, how to insulate their homes, give them everything that they needed. And within 50 years after that, 57 tribes were totally erased from the face of the earth. And it was the churches that were sent in all the time by the government. During the seizure of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, we were successful in confiscating 30 tons of records. Records that incriminated every administration from the time this government was formed. Records that talked about the churches and how they met and came together. before decisions were made by Congress or before a treaty commission was established to go in and make treaty with this tribe, the churches would first give their report. And they would talk about their great missionary work with this particular tribe and how they have educated and got something like 40 to 60% of this tribe speaking English, Christianize them. Then the government would move in, and the church, working along with the government, would coerce Indian chiefs to make treaties. Treaties that ceded large portions of land to the United States government. Treaties where Indians set aside certain portions of land for themselves and certain rights. Rights that the Great Spirit gave them and no one else. Rights of survival, the right to hunt, the right to fish, in my state to gather wild rice and trap. Water rights, mineral rights were set aside by our great chiefs because they knew that they had to look out for the unborn generation. It's always been our way of life as Indians. Knowing this, we went before the Minnesota Council of Churches, who operated what they called a Department of Indian Work. And it's true all over. It's true in Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, Cleveland, Ohio. Anywhere you go, in any state you go, they have a Minnesota Council of Churches, or a Colorado Council of Churches, or a South Dakota Council of Churches. And in every one of those councils of churches, they have a Department of Indian Work. They have various departments that are supposed to deal with social issues around them than poverty. In Minnesota, they had a Minnesota Council of Churches Department of Indian Work. And in a study that we conducted, along with many white ministers, young ministers, who were also fed up with that process and the information they gave us, we found out that the churches were ripping off the congregations to the tune of $10 million in 6 years to upgrade the conditions of Indian people in that state, only 35,000 Indians. We found out that not one Indian person sat on the board of directors. Not one Indian person worked on the staff of that department. And not one Indian person was being helped through that exploitation that the church was carrying on every Sunday and continues to carry on today. And we went in there and we demanded, like we've demanded of all other Indian organizations, that Indian people control their own destiny, that Indian people establish their own programs that's going to alleviate poverty from their community. And we presented them with an 8-point challenge. An 8-point challenge that was not only endorsed by them and eventually actually supported, but has been endorsed by 33 major denominations today. Challenges that have built in 12 major denominations, foundations and caucuses and boards to regulate that solicitation process. And hundreds of Indian self-help programs have sprung up because of that effort and because of those challenges. The following year, we journeyed to, in 1969, we went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Four people. Myself and Dennis Banks, Al Wensman, and a young youth, 15 years old, named Joe Big Bear. We found out through the ministry and those ministers that supported the American Indian Movement that the churches were operating on this level on a national basis. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, every 2 years, all of the Indian missionaries and ministers from throughout the country, the three Lutheran synods got together. And they talked about the Indian problem. They talked about poverty. They talked about alcoholism. They talked about all of these things that affect the Indian community. And after a three-day period, they'd go back home with beefed up budgets. And the following year, you'd see another new church being built on that reservation. And the poverty remained the same. We presented the Lutheran Church USA with an 8-point challenge, demanding that 75% of their board of directors be Indian and that the chairman forever be an Indian. And after a 3-day confrontation with the churches, they finally endorsed and actively supported those challenges, or so we thought. They told us that next year they would provide us with a $13,000 budget. They would let us contact Indian people from throughout the United States and bring them together to form that board that we talked about. And the following year we did just that. We established a 75% controlled Indian board that had representation from the urban areas, the rural area, the reservation, and the youth. And they told us that they were sorry they couldn't recognize that board until we went through their conferences, until we went to San Antonio and across this country every 2 years and get the conference endorsement. And I guess that's when the American Indian Movement immediately became known as a militant organization, because we grabbed the whole of Augustana College and we held it for 4 solid days. And it wasn't until we threatened to file a $1 billion lawsuit against the Lutheran Church USA that the three presidents of those three synods sent telegrams to us saying that they would recognize that board and they would actually financially support it. And in the $1 billion suit, $400 million of that was for gross violations of the Ten Commandments. And we could prove it. We could prove that they were directly responsible for the 57 tribes that were erased from the face of the earth in the name of Jesus Christ. We could prove that Colonel Shevington, the great Methodist minister, was the man that led the charge at Sand Creek and massacred the Cheyenne and the Arapaho. And we could prove that the churches stood by and watched that Wounded Knee 1890 when 280 members of Bigfoot's tribe were shot down with Hotchkiss guns. We charged another $400 million for alienation of ecumenical affections. That's when you take an Indian student from his home and away from his mother and his father, and you put him in a missionary boarding school makeup for 8 solid years, and you make him pray even if he wants to go to the toilet, and you tell him to disrespect his father and his mother. You tell him his language and his culture and his religion is wrong, that Christ is the only way. We knew that all of these were responsible for the 20-to-1 suicidal rate that Indian people are facing today. And the other $200 million were the costs and the breach of contract and the promises that they made us just a year prior to that. These challenges have been presented on a national basis and now on a world basis. And we say today that if the hierarchy of the church would allow the congregation down to the congregation level to hear these challenges, they too would have supported them. And there would have never been a trail of broken treaties. There have never been $2.1 million in damage to the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in Washington, D.C. And Lawrence Lamont and Frank Clearwater, Pedro Bessonette, and the others that died at Wounded Knee would still be alive today. In March of 1969, we launched a full-scale attack against the federal government. Not many people in America paid attention to that. There's a lot of other struggles were going on at that time. Nobody thought the Indian would ever stand up or do these things, but we were successful in holding and occupying 9 of the area offices of the Bureau of Indian Affairs for 2 solid weeks in March of 1969, and then started the treks back and forth to Washington, D.C. Every time we went there, they said that they were going to shake up the Interior Department. They're going to restructure the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They're going to put Indian people in charge. Indian people are going to make decisions. Nixon said that Indian people are going to have self-determination without termination. Then he turned around and established a National Council on Indian Opportunity under Vice President Spiro T. Agnew. And they hired a white man called Robert Robertson. Said he'd be in office for 90 days, and Indian people themselves would be able to select the director. And he's been there ever since. And under that, they formed the National Tribal Chairman's Association. Comes directly under Nixon, Agnew, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Robertson, right down the line to people like Dickie Wilson on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Set up the same way, the same thing in mind, to terminate Indian people and take what little left that they have. The American Indian Movement continued for 5 solid years to demonstrate its concern in the areas of health, education, and welfare. And when they were unable to change the curriculum in the public school system in the state of Minnesota and elsewhere, where we had chapters springing up all over the country, we established our own schools. We call it the American Indian Movement Survival School, where they still learn the basics, except that English in our school is taught as a foreign language. Our students are taught to speak Chippewa again. They're taught to speak Sioux. They're taught to respect their elders. They're taught the values that it's better to share, better to give than to receive. And they're taught respect for their mother, the earth, and are taught a spiritualism and a religion that all living things, including the trees and the plant life, and the fall and the fish in the water, are their brothers and sisters. We have 76 dropouts in our school today. 34 of them referred to us by the juvenile courts of Minneapolis. And in a 3-year period, not one kid, not one of these children have dropped out of our school. All of these slow learners and these potential dropouts and these pushouts were still going to school. We brought in a young Jewish couple who were friends to the movement to evaluate the achievements of these children, along with a young man by the name of Ralph Ware, a full-blooded Kiowa Indian, clinical psychologist. In over a 3-month period, they found out that these children's learning ability, capacity to learn had jumped from 0.5 to 1.5 grade levels higher than their white public school counterpart. That school is hard to get recognition and accreditation for it today when they talk about busing, integration, and racial balance. But we tell them that they've been busing Indians for years. They've been busing them from Alaska to Chilocco, Oklahoma. They've been busing them from White Earth, Minnesota, my reservation, to Haskell, to Flangeau, to Wapton, and to the other 235 Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding schools across this country. And it hasn't worked for Indian people. Well, there's a few that make it. There's a few. If their father works in the Bureau and they got a little bit of money, they go on to a higher education. And because of that, we do have a few people around, like Vine Deloria today, who's well-educated, putting out books. We have a few attorneys like Ramon Roubidoux, who was able to make it all the way through. But the majority of Indian people were turned into hairstylists, carpenters, mechanics. And this was all a plot and a plan of the federal government to get us off their land, because there was no place to practice that trade there, and put us into urban ghettos across this country so they can disenfranchise us and take what little we have left. For 6 solid years, we carried signs, prayed, sang songs, beat a drum, marched, drug off Mount Rushmore 2 years in a row, protesting the violation of the Treaty of 1868. And every time we got arrested and we cited a treaty, before we got to the courts, judges would disqualify themselves because they were landholders in direct conflict with that treaty. And we'd end up without a case. And we went there to get arrested. Went there to get arrested just to get the treaty before the courts where they could deal with it and find out where is white America? That's what we wanted to know. Where is this government in relationship to treaties? July and August of 1972, we call all of our chapters from throughout the country to come to the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota. And for 3 solid days, we sat down and we re-evaluated the movement itself. Looked at everything that we did for 5 solid years. We found out that millions and millions of dollars more was being spent on Indian people because of the advocacy that we put forth. More organizations were being formed. We found out there are 2,800 Indian organizations now today operating in the United States. But we found out also that the statistics and the conditions of Indian people remain virtually the same. We decided then that we had launched one more effort, an effort that would pull together one of the greatest alliances to ever take place here in the Western Hemisphere, one that would surpass even our great grandfather Tecumseh from this area, one that would make every Indian person in this country either stand up and be counted or remain an Uncle Tomahawk or an apple or whatever they were. We would launch a caravan from the West Coast, and we would travel for 1.5 months before we would get to St. Paul. And along the way, we would stop in every urban ghetto setting where Indian people resided, in every reservation. And we'd ask them to join us, because when we got to St. Paul, we were going to have a conference, and we were going to decide our relationship to the federal government once and for all. Over 200 tribes met in St. Paul, Minnesota. Delegates and representatives from almost every movement organization in the country in relationship to Indian affairs gathered there. And we didn't sit down and talk about the Indian problem anymore. We talked about a white problem. We talked about the problem in Washington and how they're recreating problems for Indian people. And when we got through with our two-week conference, we came out with a 20-point solution paper. 20 points that legislation could be built and drafted around that would bring forth what the president said: Indians will have self-determination without termination. And we sent an advance crew into Washington, D.C. to make sure that we would have the type of public forums with these federal agencies that would be needed, and with these congressional leaders and these various departments of the Interior, to get endorsement of the 20-point solution paper and some type of commitment and promise to us that they would act on these. They told Indian people that this is what they were searching for. If Indian people would just come forth and tell us what they wanted, we would give it to them. And when we got to Washington, D.C., all of the meetings that were established 2 weeks before, for some reason, were closed down. It was election week, and they didn't want any type of a police problem in Washington. And we know today that the administration itself was responsible for what happened in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. When we got to Washington, D.C., even the churches closed their doors in our face. So the only place that we had to go as Indian people was to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the number one enemy in this country, oldest bureaucracy alive today, established under the War Department 149 years ago to regulate trade between the Indian nation and the United States government. And when 500 Indian people gathered inside the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the commissioner, who was Indian, welcomed us. But the man from the Land Management Department, Harrison Lesh, told us at 5 o'clock he wanted us out of his building. A white man in a Bureau of Indian Affairs building telling us he wanted us out of his building. A building that was built off the ripoff of Indian people's land and its resources. They don't have no Bureau of Black Affairs or Bureau of White Affairs, except the White House in D.C. But they had a Bureau of Indian Affairs, and we were determined to do something to change it. And at 4:45, we looked out the windows, and they did what they have done across this country. They amassed all of their military support. They had every pig in Washington, D.C. surrounding us. Even sat some on horseback in riot gear and gas masks trying to scare us. But there are many chiefs inside the Bureau building. There are many spiritual leaders and medicine men. And when we asked Indian people, the old women and the children, to leave, they would not leave. People like Martha Grass, who had been traveling to Washington for 40 years, said she was tired. And as far as she was concerned, she was going to get an answer before she left Washington, D.C., or she was going to die there in that Bureau building. And I saw 500 people come together into one mind and make a decision that all of them were going to stand together. And for 5 solid days, we negotiated. We fought down every attempt by every federal judge to remove us from that building with the legal team that we had. We were even able to overturn restraining orders that kept us out of Arlington National Cemetery, where we wish to go and gather and have a ceremony for Ira Hayes and the other Indians that died in these white man's wars. And finally, on the 8th of November, we told them that we were all through talking to their flunkies. We're all too talking to people who have been oppressing and suppressing Indian people's rights. We're all through talking to Interior people, and Justice Department people, health, education, welfare, and all these other agencies. And we notified the committee to re-elect the president who came to visit us that if the fat man himself was not on the phone in 1 hour, guaranteeing us that he was going to come and meet or send a representative from the White House, that there wasn't going to be a Bureau of Indian Affairs building. And within 1 hour, they flew a man by the name of John Ehrlichman to come and meet with us. And after a series of negotiations, where we were able to get commitments signed by him and Frank Carlucci and Leonard Garment, we decided that we would leave the Bureau of Indian Affairs and go home. But we were broke then and we needed money, and we told them that. We could not get our people home to their reservations and where they came from unless we had the money to do so. And John Ehrlichman asked us how much we needed. It was the fastest proposal I ever wrote in my life. It came out to $66,650. And within 1 hour's time, a brown satchel case was delivered with $66,650 in $100 bills. And we left Washington, D.C. with a police escort, and 30 tons of files back home. And just a week after we left, the White House closed off all future negotiations, stating that they would not talk anymore about the solution paper until they got their records back. The records have never been returned. And within 1 month after we left, a federal grand jury met in Washington, D.C., and they indicted 12 of us, every one of us, American Indian Movement people. They didn't bother to touch the other 84% who represented reservations and land and treaties. But there hasn't been a warrant issued to date. And we found out now that one of the reasons why was the money that they gave us that they tried to tax Indian people for across this country. They immediately moved to grab all the federal funds from our survival schools, saying they were being used for revolutionary purposes, which we sued and eventually got back. But the money that they really gave us did not come from the Department of Transportation or the Bureau of Indian Affairs or the Office of Economic Opportunity. One of the reasons why they did not arrest us is the money came from the committee to re-elect the president. And when we started our long trek home, this puppet government that was established under the National Council of Indian Opportunity, and people like Webster Tuhok, who was chairman of the Rosebud Sioux tribe, an Episcopal minister on leave, and people like Richard Dickey Wilson started to condemn us. There were only two in the country that did that. When we got back home, they put restraining orders against us. We couldn't stand up in a public forum on our own land, in our own reservations, and tell the Indian people who could not make it to Washington, D.C., about the lies and the deceit and the corruption there. We weren't allowed to do that because there was orders given down to the line to the tribal presidents under the vice president's desk to put a muzzle on the American Indian movement. And we knew then that we were on the enemy's list. And as soon as we got home, we started hearing about the people who were murdered when we were gone. We heard about Raymond Yellow Thunder, who was stripped from the waist down in Gordon, Nebraska, 18 miles from Pine Ridge. A 56-year-old man who worked as a ranch hand all summer and had nothing else to do but to drink all winter long, but enjoyed himself, was stripped from the waist down and shoved out into an American Legion post where the John Birchers were having a party and made to dance naked like an Indian. And 2 weeks later, they found them dead, frozen in a car lot. They picked up four whites, two brothers, another fellow and his sister. And they admitted that they picked Raymond Yellow Thunder up. They made him strip from the waist down. They beat him, took him to the dance floor, shoved him out to make him dance, put him back in the trunk of the car in 20 degrees below zero weather, and then dumped him off in this used car lot where he died. And over 1,400 Indians marched on Gordon, Nebraska when we got back from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. There's only 2,200 Indian people lived in Gordon at that time, and 10% of them were Indian. And before we got there, there was an exodus of all the whites leaving town, their trailer houses and everything else that they could gather. And from there, we ended up in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, attempting to form some type of coalition with our Chicano brothers and sisters and the Indians in that community who were afraid to even go out after dark in Nebraska and Scott's Bluff. We knew then that the government was after us because they immediately, we don't know if they were afraid because of the Bureau of Indian Affairs or what, but immediately when they found out the American Indian Movement was going to Scott's Bluff, Nebraska, they called out the National Guard. And Governor Exon said, we are not going to have a Bureau of Indian Affairs in Nebraska. They called out 50 state troopers. They called out the Special Operations Group from Washington, D.C. And they surrounded us during a spiritual conference in the Chicano community. And before the conference ended, in 3 days, 38 of our people were arrested illegally, placed in jail for a variety of conspiracy-type charges. And during that time, a young man by the name of Wesley Badheart Bull was set upon late January of 1972 or 73 in Buffalo Gap, South Dakota, just a little ways off the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. He was stabbed 27 times by four whites in broad daylight. They, too, were only charged with second-degree manslaughter. And on February 6th, they were scheduled to appear for their preliminary hearing in Custer, South Dakota. And the call went out to Indian people again to gather in Custer on February 6th. That we were going to confront this judicial system, which has never presented a first-degree murder bill against Indian people for the past, against whites for killing Indians in the past 25 years. And the letter that went out across the country, it told Indian people to come there prepared to die. But when they decided to go into Custer, South Dakota, the medicine men were successful in stopping any Indian from taking any type of weapon that was white in there with them. That they would go there simply with a peace pipe and their spiritualism. And the medicine man would lead us in, our spiritual leader, Leonard Crowdog. And when they got there, they locked up the courthouse. They had the whole town, in fact, locked up. And vigilantes in whites were standing on the rooftops with shotguns, pitchforks, whatever they could get their hands on. And only 200 Indian people drove into that town and went to the federal building to talk to the judge, to talk to the state attorney general, talk to the state attorney's office. And while Russell Means and Dennis Banks and four others were inside negotiating, a policeman attacked Wesley Badhart Bull's sister, or aunt. And a riot immediately erupted, a police riot. And before it was over, the courthouse was burning, and the Chamber of Commerce was burned to the ground. And 17 federal officers were in a hospital, critically wounded, beaten up, broken arms, backs, and everything. We went to Sturgis. We went to Rapid City. We went to every county seat in that area to attempt to get brothers out of jail who were being held on $50,000, $70,000, $100,000 for like charges. And all during this time on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, we were receiving reports from our people that this AIM person got beat up last night. This person that sympathized with the American Indian Movement got it. Our national press secretary's house was firebombed with his wife inside. American Indian Movement women were being picked off the streets and drug into jail and physically assaulted by goon squads and white ranchers. And they told us that the federal government had sandbagged every federal building in town and that 50 marshals were already there. They had machine gun nests, because there was a threat that the American Indian Movement might come on that reservation. And on February 18th, after a series of meetings with our traditional chiefs and headmen, the Oklala Civil Rights Organization, the Landowners Association, the landlords themselves, we issued a national press statement stating that we were well aware of the conspiracy that was taking place on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, a conspiracy from Nixon all the way down to Dickie Wilson to lure the American Indian Movement on there so they could massacre us. We were getting calls every day from Washington, D.C., telling us not to go on there. They're going to get us. But on February 18th, we told the people that we were not going to stand by any longer. That's all these Indian people had to do was invite us, and we would come, because we had been committed to do that since we formed in 68. And on February 26th and 27th, we met at Calico Hall on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, 14 miles from the tribal seat. And after a two-day meeting, where we conducted an all-Indian grand jury hearing and heard close to 1,500 complaints, all of this information was turned over to the traditional chiefs and headmen for them to make the final decision on what to do. And they retired along with the leadership of the American Indian Movement. And after a 3-hour conference, They all got up and shook one another's hand and smoked the pipe. And then it was interpreted to us what had taken place. And the traditional chiefs and headmen asked the American Indian movement to do whatever was necessary to put a check and a stop to the tyranny on that reservation. They told us that Wounded Knee was the heart of exploitation on that reservation. They said only 42 families live there, but they have 12 churches, and they're getting ready to build another one. They said they have a trading post there and a food store, and not only every family in that community, but most of the other Indians on the reservation are in debt and enslaved to that trading post. A trading post that operated for 25 solid years without a license. A trading post where Indian people were forced, when they were hungry, to sell their beadwork and their quill work and their sacred artifacts for $5 in food. And the next day you would see it in a showcase being sold anywhere from $50 to $100. They picked Wounded Knee to make this stand that would not only create a national awareness to the problems that Indian people were forced to live under in this country, but would create a worldwide awareness in relationship to the treaty situation with Indian people. And on the 27th, when we grabbed and seized Wounded Knee, the whole world, and particularly the administration and people like Senator George McGovern, got uptight. Within 2 hours after the occupation took place, they had 24 armed personnel carriers surrounding us. And we found out that they were parked for 10 solid days 23 miles away in Martin, South Dakota. Now you tell me who was in conspiracy. They had 150 Federal Bureau of Investigation officers at Wounded Knee. They recruited 180 Bureau of Indian Affairs law enforcement from other agencies and from other reservations throughout the country. And 86 ranchers formed within 2 days and were endorsed by the governor of the state of South Dakota. A vigilante group that was supposed to be a special operations group for the future, if such a thing should happen. And the Indian people inside didn't have hardly any weapons. A few 22s and shotguns, what they used to hunt with. They didn't have any tanks. They didn't have any submachine guns. They didn't have helicopters. They didn't have phantom jets that strafed us every morning to wake the people up and scare them and try to get them to fight along with one another and leave. Didn't have none of that type of equipment. That's all we had was a sacred pipe and an altar, a purification ceremony, and a willingness to die for what we believed in. And we know today that we would not be here, we would not be alive, if it wasn't for the fact that white America and America itself stood up. It wasn't for the fact that the President of the United States was receiving hundreds and thousands of letters and telegrams a day, not only from people here at home, but from abroad. We knew that they would have came in. The first man to show up on the scene was the only person that we would never invite anywhere, was Senator George Armstrong McGovern. And he came there because he was concerned about the so-called white hostages. He wasn't concerned at all for the old people that chose to make that stand with us. He wasn't concerned at all about the children that were inside Wounded Knee. He wasn't concerned at all about the fact that something like 64% or 64 of the people inside Wounded Knee had pneumonia. He wasn't concerned at all about the fact that we had no insulin in there for the diabetics. He was only concerned for the Gildersleeves and those people who had been ripping Indian people off for years, and the missionaries. But even they refused to leave. They told George McGovern if they were hostages, they were hostages of the federal government and not of the American Indian Movement or the Oglala Sioux people. And they told George McGovern that if they would have listened to Indian people in Washington, D.C., we would not be at Wounded Knee. For 71 solid days, a little ragtag band, is what some reporters referred to it as, of Indians, held Wounded Knee against the most powerful forces in the world, or so they thought. For 71 solid days, hundreds and thousands of rounds of machine gun fire were poured into that village, and the public was led to believe that the American Indian Movement fired 150 shots. We responded with 175, and the firefight's over for the night. We were in Wounded Knee. We know that trailer houses collapsed in there because they took so much machine gun fire. And if it wasn't for our spiritual leadership and the elders who we listened to inside Wounded Knee, not one of us would be alive today. I know what Castro and people were talking about when they said Crazy Horse and Geronimo, some of the greatest guerrilla fighters in the world, because I witnessed it for 71 solid days. Every time they opened fire, I saw the people crawl into the ground because our medicine man said that our mother would protect us. The people were led to believe that Indians were fighting Indians at Wounded Knee. We were fighting a corrupt administration that was put together in 1934 under the Indian Reorganization Act, an act that is a termination policy for tribal government and for our land. And we were fighting people who thought and had the same mentality as those who are caught in a trap today in Washington, D.C. Nobody said anything about the women and what part they played at Wounded Knee. The press sensationalized everything. They never once talked about the independent Oglala Sioux Nation that was established there. They never once talked about that we didn't no longer have a perimeter but borders to defend. They never talked about the violations of the agreement that was signed on April 5th, which prolonged the occupation for another month. You see, in the last month of the occupation, all of the press conferences were held in the Bureau of Indian Affairs building on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And the only people who journeyed over those hills and through those federal forces to come in and get the true story were movement people from throughout the United States. And 39 foreign countries came in to visit with us and do documentaries. We know today that if the administration was able to discredit the American Indian Movement, get the public's eye away from Wounded Knee, that they would have came in the same way that they did at Kent State, Attica, or anywhere else they've been. But we knew that we had 51% support of the American public. It came out in the Harris survey. It came out that 29% supported the occupation, but not the armed confrontation. But 51% supported the armed confrontation because they knew we tried every other avenue of redress. And only 21% supported the United States government. 2 weeks later, they took a survey, and 67% of the American people believed that Nixon was lying. At Wounded Knee, we had more support than the President of the United States. Today, 149 people are scheduled to go before the white courts here in America. As the leadership trial started Tuesday, they also started to select a jury to try 129 other people in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a state where they have already determined that Indian people could not get a fair trial, and where they moved our case from there to St. Paul, they are still moving ahead to try what they call the non-leadership cases. 84 of those non-leadership cases are Indian women, the first 14 people to go to court in South Dakota are Indian women. We know that this is a tactic of the United States government of divide and conquer. It always has been. To divide the resources of the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee. We know it's a tactic to try to attempt to get an immediate conviction in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 240 miles away, so they can immediately prejudice the case that has taken place in St. Paul. And we know that the government was never at Wounded Knee to reach a just settlement, because the chief negotiator stated 4 days after the occupation ended on May 12th that he went there to destroy the American Indian movement. And he said that's exactly what they did. I got news for him. Tuesday morning, to give you a little idea of what's going on in St. Paul, to enter the courtroom, you'd think you're getting on an airplane. You have to go through metal detectors. You're searched by federal marshals. You're escorted to two private elevators that have been sealed off. Nobody else can travel them on but people that want to go to the court. You're taken to the seventh floor. You get out. You go through metal detectors again. Your hand searched. Then you are escorted into the courtroom and seated. Tuesday morning, 80 traditional chiefs and headmen and their wives and spiritual leaders from the Pine Ridge Reservation walked from the state capitol to the federal building in their full regalia, in their full traditional dress. And they stated to Judge Fred Nickel and to the United States government and to the world that they were the traditional chiefs and headmen, that their fathers signed the Treaty of 1868, that they were the ones that were responsible for Wounded Knee because they were the ones that called the American Indian Movement in there. They demanded the release of all people charged. And they demanded that the government try them if they want to try someone in their white courts. And Tuesday morning, Russell Means and Dennis Banks were allowed to make their own opening statement to the jury. We have an all-white jury in St. Paul composed of 9 women and 3 men. But we feel it's one of the best juries to ever be put together in this country in a conspiracy trial. Because the people who perfected the jury selection process, who have worked in 36 other major conspiracy trials, were there in support of us, along with our medicine men. Russell Means' statement was only objected to once. But when Dennis Banks got up to speak in front of all the traditional chiefs and the jury and everybody else, the press, and when he tried to lay the foundation for to introduce the Treaty of 1868 as his defense and as our defense, the prosecution immediately objected. Tried to say it wasn't a treaty issue. The treaty could not be used. But Dennis Banks continued to speak. Pretty soon the judge was objecting. William Kunstler jumped up to object to the judge. The judge told him to be seated, and then Mark Lane jumped up. Then Ken Tilson jumped up. Then the four prosecuting attorneys jumped up. The marshal said, if you don't be seated, I'm going to call the marshals and have you ejected. And they said they would have to be carried out because they were not walking out of that courtroom. And he brought the marshals in and ejected all of them, including Dennis Banks, the major defendant. Then he realized what he did, you know, this great liberal judge from the state of South Dakota who requested that he hear these cases because he tried a couple of other Indian cases already. Called a recess immediately and called everybody into his chambers. And after a half hour, they went back into the courtroom and he apologized and told the jury that he was in error four times. He apologized to the jury, to the prosecution, to the defense, to defendants, and then the dignitaries that were there.